This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
188, 189,
yeah. Early Saturday morning at a Shoppers Food warehouse outside of Washington, D.C., customers lined up, not for bread or even to check out, but for flu shots.
We're standing in line, but I don't think we have any chance of getting the shot. The line is wiggling around from the beginning of the store all the way around to the back and then through the aisles and all the way back to the end of the store.
188.
I'm here among hundreds of other people this morning in the frozen food section, freezing, wishing I could get something to eat, but I don't want to lose my spot.
198. Hugh Workman.
They said they were giving out numbers at 6, so I got here at 4:45. This was started at 9 o'clock. They haven't started yet.
So we got a number. They got to go to the produce side. To the one side, if we got herbicide.
Next one is 199, Julia O'Connor.
Me.
That's my DM.
Marcia Weinberg, Lisa Keenan, and Marvin Trattner, all from Maryland. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Patrick Libby, Executive Director of the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
How typical is that scene across the country?
Unfortunately, it is more typical than not. We are hearing from our members, local health departments throughout the country, that clinics similar to that are part of their daily experience now.
Mm-hmm. Later in the program, we're going to be hearing from a doctor who specializes in infectious diseases and from NPR's health policy correspondent, Joanne Silberner, who's been covering this story. If you have questions about the flu vaccine shortage or want to share your own trials and tribulations, give us a call. The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll also go to Kabul in Afghanistan for an update on that country's presidential elections, but first, flu shots. Patrick Libby, what does public health law allow officials to do in a situation like this?
Well, first, public health, your local health departments throughout the country are attempting to first ascertain how much vaccine is actually available in their community, not just at the health department, but in the clinical community and in, like you heard on the tape, mm-hmm. The increasing numbers of larger scale retail outlets or places of employment kinds of clinics. So the first step is to get a handle on how much actually exists, and then voluntarily, hopefully, achieve among those providers an agreement that the high priority populations are who that will be targeted to.
Hopefully is an important word. Can authorities confiscate vaccine and redistribute it?
Well, first, perhaps a step before that, and we're seeing this increasingly across the country at the local level and in a number of states, where the health officer has actually issued an order under the emergency powers they have under their respective state laws. And most of those orders we've seen have been focused on ensuring or obligating providers to limit the use of the vaccine they have available to those high-risk populations.
And who decides who's high risk and who isn't?
Well, what we are using at this point is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidelines that identifies the high-risk populations, primarily elderly, infants ages 6 months through 24 months, and persons with certain conditions.
If I'm a perfectly healthy 54-year-old, if I go in and say, but I've got a certain condition, is there any way to check?
That will vary probably point to point, and it'll vary on the extent or how much vaccine is available. In the main, I suspect health departments and providers, well, provider may know your medical history, mm-hmm. and health departments will probably take on trust.
Okay. Whom should people contact to find out where to get flu shots, where they live, their county or their city?
I would recommend that the first point of contact, if they don't have a provider of their own, would be with their local health department, city or county health department.
Do you know if hotlines or websites are being set up?
Those are being set up in a number of health departments, but call into the general number and they will refer you. They should have a handle to the extent that there is vaccine available in clinics being held.
Now, do we know how much vaccine there is and where it is?
We know that at a community level, we don't have as good a handle as we would like in a national level. That is, if you think about how vaccine has been distributed in this country over the last several years, it goes out to by purchase to private providers, clinicians, to health departments, and to these increasingly larger mass vaccination programs. So there is no one point in the country that has a handle on how much vaccine is in distribution and at what communities. We are working with the Centers for Disease Control quickly to stand up a tracking and reporting system on vaccine availability and the extent to which it's properly targeted.
But it's important to emphasize this is a private system. It's not a government system now.
That's correct. The manufacturer of the vaccine is done on a private basis, and it is a purchase agreement between providers, whether the providers are public, as in the case of health departments, or private, as in the case of clinicians.
Is there any difference between the vaccine, the shots that an elderly person might get and that a school child might get?
There are some technical differences in terms of size of dosage, but it is by and large the same vaccine.
Mm-hmm. And is there more of one than the other?
There is enough vaccine by manufacturer for every high-risk child. That may not be the case for every potential high-risk senior or other adult with medical condition.
Every high-risk child, not every child.
That is correct.
Okay. What do you think, now that we're in this mess, what do you think should be done to remedy it?
Well, clearly this has been a problem that I think many have seen coming over time. But in our last several years, there was actually excess manufacture that ended up actually being disposed of, mm-hmm. Which has in part led to some of the problems we've had. I think coming out of this current year situation, it really is going to require a careful look at a policy wherein manufacturers have some insurance, and there may well be a public and a government role of ensuring an adequate supply, even if it means underwriting some of the manufacture.
The government might be the purchaser of last resort or something
right.
like that. Now, the flu vaccine obviously lasts only one season. It's got to be made up fresh every year.
It is a targeted vaccine to what is seen as occurring in another part of the world and timing-wise that we would expect to see in this country during our flu season.
And a great deal will depend this flu season, given the shortage of the vaccine, on how bad a flu season it's going to be.
That is definitely a concern, yes. Mm-hmm. Again, part of the reason for the targeting is to ensure those people who are most at risk for the most serious consequences from having contracted influenza or the flu are the first to receive that shot.
Mm-hmm. Would you anticipate that there are going to be some places, some cities, some counties, some buildings, some areas that aren't going to get enough?
I think that may well prove to be the case, because what we're dealing with is a situation that is in part shaped by where did you place your orders for vaccine some number of months ago. And if you, a community or even a region, place their orders predominantly with Chiron, they're going to find themselves in a shorter supply situation.
Chiron, of course, the British company
yes.
that whose manufacturer was found to be contaminated.
Part of what CDC is working on in concert with local health departments and state health departments, again, is getting a handle on that and redistributing to the extent possible the remaining unshipped Aventis vaccine product.
That's the other company. Yeah,
thank you.
Major
yes.
other company. Yeah. CDC is obviously the Center for Disease Control. Now, do you think that this situation this year is going to affect how many people get vaccinated in the future?
I would hope that this is not a deterrent for people thinking about this into the future. If anything, part of what we are experiencing now is in terms of demand, both obviously the news story itself, but the public health community and the medical community in general has been encouraging and recommending an increasing number of people receive the flu vaccine. Up until literally 13 days ago, we were operating with an assumption that we had more than enough vaccine based on our prior year's actual use.
Mm-hmm. Our number again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Let's talk with Joanna, who's calling from Marshall, Minnesota.
Hi, I was calling. Will the distribution of the vaccine that's available be, do you think there's a need to concentrate it in the urban areas? I'm calling from a rural area of Minnesota that hasn't received vaccine as of yet, and I'm wondering if, because of the concentration in urban areas, if there's more of a need there than, say, in smaller areas.
My understanding is that the initial decisions on allocation of the remaining unshipped stock will have more to do with how much may be available and what is the size of the risk population. I have not heard it spoken to that they would be looking at density or concentration of population as a factor.
I'm not sure that that's a complete answer, Joanna, but we don't know is the answer.
I see.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, Patrick Libby. We thank you for your time today. Going to be a busy few weeks, I suspect, for you.
Certainly feeling that way.
Patrick Libby is Executive Director of the National Association of County and City Health Officials. He was kind enough to come in and speak with us here in Studio 3A. Also with us in the studio is NPR health correspondent Joanne Silberner. Always good to have you on the program, Joanne.
Good to be here, Neil.
Yes, she does have a cold. It's only a cold, people. Bear with us. At a news conference in Tampa, Florida this morning, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, said there is enough vaccine to go around for most people who need it. True?
Yeah. Well, is that true? Most is a very broad word. Yeah, most people, yeah. All people, probably not. He also told people to relax, that he didn't want people standing online and panicking, and I think not panicking is always a good idea. He also said the flu season hasn't started yet. That is true, but last year it started around this time, and the vaccine does take a couple of weeks to work, so it would be good to get things going as soon as possible.
Well, another thing that Secretary Thompson said at that news conference down in Tampa was that flu vaccine supply would be reallocated to parts of the country where it's needed the most. Is this being done, and if so, who's doing it?
It's already being done. It started last week. CDC and Aventis Pasteur got together and announced that they had sent 2 million vaccinations to the Veterans Administration, to long-term care facilities, to some state public health officials. So they've started it. It's as Mr. Libby said, this is not being done by law or by anything like that. It's being done by agreement and a cooperative need to try and get this to the people who need it.
So sort of an ad hoc arrangement.
Yes.
Now, we've been reading that some health experts have been warning the government about the fragility of the flu vaccine system for years now. What have you found out about that?
Well, it's, you know, we've been reporting it too. It's been out there. This is one of the big frustrations for public health officials for almost any condition. Getting money for prevention has been traditionally a very difficult thing to do. And we've had the Institute of Medicine issuing countless reports. The Government Accountability Office has issued a number of interesting studies. Centers for Disease Control and National Institutes of Health go to Congress every year asking for more money and not getting it.
Mm-hmm. One other thing from Secretary Thompson's news conference today, he advised people if they wanted a flu shot to first go to their doctor or their local clinic. If that fails, he said they should contact the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta.
I don't know how much they're going to know. One of the other places, if you go to the CDC website, they suggest you go to the American Lung Association website. I tried that this morning and put in 10 zip codes within 20 miles and got nothing, got no places that were open.
So this may be something that's not up yet.
Possibly,
or maybe no help at all. The CDC must be getting flooded with phone calls also.
I imagine. There are a lot of people out there who are very worried, and for good reason. The CDC and Aventis together say they still have about 20 million doses to administer. There will be vaccine coming online over time. It's going to be interesting to see how effective they are in getting it to the people who need it, because some of the vaccine that was out there already before the shortage was announced went to healthy people who were trying to be good citizens.
Because every year, I think it's Secretary Thompson who comes out and tells us we should all get a flu shot.
Well, they've been bringing that in gradually. They brought in kids in the last few years. Kids weren't always in there, but last year was a particularly bad year for children. You know, it's always been the over 65s, and they've been expanding it gradually. And a lot of public health people said, you know, maybe we should have expanded it in a bigger way by getting some more manufacturers in and getting these manufacturers guaranteeing them some sort of sales figures so that they would be more confident about producing more vaccine. But that wasn't done.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to take more of your calls and emails about the shortage of the flu vaccine and what to do about it. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This hour, we're talking about flu shots, or the lack thereof. Our guest is NPR's Joanne Silberner. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk to Michael, who's with us from Tigard, Oregon.
Hi, that's Tigard.
Tigard, okay. I apologize for the mispronunciation.
Okay, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, on Friday, my wife and I were thinking about, well, how can we get flu shots because we're not over 65 and we're not babies? So we live in the Portland, Oregon area, and I was looking around on the Internet and found an old article in USA Today about how there was a clinic in Vancouver, BC's airport that gives flu shots. So I called them up and asked them if they had them, and they said they did. And I asked if they would give them to Americans, and they said they would. So on Saturday, my wife and I flew up for the day to Vancouver from Portland, and we got our, if you add the airfare into it, our $200 flu shots.
But you feel protected now.
Well, yeah, I do. And I'm pleased to have been able to get a flu shot.
Okay, Michael, thanks very much. Appreciate the phone call. Is that going to be an option for people who live near Canada?
I think people have already headed up there. How much the Canadians are going to put up with, I don't know. You know, they have their own supply, which is probably enough for them. And at some point, I think that they may start to look a little askance at this. But I imagine in the short run, there will be people who head up that way.
During the debate the other night with Senator Kerry, President Bush said they hope to get more supplies of flu vaccine from Canada. Has anybody, any progress been reported on that?
Not that I know of yet. And they are looking at other countries. But other countries, I think, are, you know, they've got what they need. And, you know, companies don't tend to produce an overabundance of this vaccine. I think we may be able to get a little bit here, a little bit there, but we're not going to get the tens of millions of doses that we need.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Annie is with us from Sandy, Utah.
Hi.
Hi.
Just to echo the other caller, my sister's in Toronto. She let me know that everybody she knows has had a flu shot, and also the flu shots are free. So the other point I wanted to bring up is that from what I've read, and I've read a lot, I believe the Bush administration has known about this concern regarding the shortages for a long time. And the Wall Street Journal addressed something that I just think is an interesting point. There isn't any profit for the big farm companies to make these vaccines. They don't really want to take it on. They make big profit with things like Viagra, and there are three big companies that profit from that, but they don't want to mess with something that's not profitable. And so I just want to leave you with that thought. If you'd like to comment, I'd appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Okay, and I also have to make a correction. I said on the air that Chiron was a British company. It's an American company that was making the vaccine in a British plant, so I apologize for that. What about Annie's point?
Well, let me see what to say about that. Wait, I'm sorry, was this in terms of going to Canada?
No, she said that she had a sister in Canada who did say that they had vaccine up there. But she was talking about the profitability of...
I'm sorry. The profitability issue is a real one. You know, when you sell a cholesterol-lowering drug, people are taking it every day. When you sell Viagra, well, I don't know how often people are taking it, but it might be fairly often. Flu shot is a once-a-year deal, and it's tended to be maybe $10, $15, $20, $30, and that's it. And companies are worried about liability, which is an open question. We're looking into that. I think you can listen to NPR and hear some reports on that coming up. But it is not a huge moneymaker. It costs a lot to produce. These are made, they're still growing the virus in eggs. The eggs have to be injected with the vaccine. It's not something that they make a lot of money on.
And obviously, these things take time. It's why they couldn't just ramp up production now.
It takes about 6 months beginning to end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Annie, thanks very much for the phone call. Even if you can't get a flu shot this year, there are some practical steps that all of us can take to minimize the risk of catching the flu. Joining us now is Dr. John Traynor, professor of medicine in the Infectious Diseases Unit at the University of Rochester. He's at member station WXXI in Rochester, New York. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Given this situation that there's simply not enough vaccine to go around, what basic steps can people take to protect themselves and their families?
Well, of course, you can always use common sense. We recognize that flu is spread in a variety of different ways, partly by aerosol and partly by large particle droplets. And using what oftentimes is referred to as respiratory etiquette, covering your mouth when you cough, washing your hands, things like that, can probably make an impact in the transmission of flu and would be things that would be good for people to just do routinely.
So basic sanitation.
Right. Basic things your mother taught you about using a handkerchief when you sneeze and covering your mouth when you cough and washing your hands are probably just as true now as they were then.
How does the flu virus attack the system? Anybody who's run down, tired, stressed out, in other words, the typical American, are they at greater risk?
Well, there's a lot of information that suggests that stress does impact your risk of acquiring infectious diseases because of subtle effects on the immune system. But the main way that you end up getting the flu is really just by being in the wrong place at the wrong time and being exposed to someone who has the flu. And that's why another factor that could impact transmission would be if people who were sick stayed home from work or from school. Now, that's a lot to ask in situations where people don't necessarily have sick leave. But to the extent that people with the flu can stay out of public places, I think that will have some impact on transmission.
Well, Joanne, who's sitting about 4 feet away from me, clearly has a cold at least. How does she tell the difference between the cold and the flu?
Well, that's another great question, and probably the biggest differentiating feature is the presence of fever. Fever is not typical of the common cold, but is very typical of the flu. Other things that you get with the flu are that very sudden onset of the all-over achy feeling and general malaise, which are really out of proportion sometimes to the respiratory symptoms and which are very typical of flu and not of the common cold.
Are you feeling warm, Joanne?
No, I don't have a fever, and all my symptoms are above the neck.
Okay, thanks. Now, let's get another caller on the line. This is Lisa, who's with us from Manchester, New Hampshire.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
I have diabetes, which I haven't heard anything specific, but I'm assuming that diabetes is one of the chronic conditions that is probably recommended to have a flu shot. I also have other health conditions. However, I am in generally in good health, and I don't work at this time. I'm wondering if my risk is low enough that I should defer having the flu vaccine in favor of the elderly and the children who are more at risk than I am.
Dr. Trainer?
Well, Lisa, I'd still tell you, you really should get your flu shot. Diabetes is actually one of the conditions that is well recognized to increase the risk of a hospitalization or a severe prolonged illness if you do get the flu, and you would be one of the people that we really would like to see vaccinated. Now, having said that, it's also true that many physicians are struggling within those risk groups, trying to decide among people who are at high risk, who are the highest risk people. And it turns out that it's very difficult to really parse those lists into smaller, even higher target groups. And that's why you haven't seen any sort of listing in rank order of the people in those groups, because it's just really not possible to do that.
The kind of triage list to...
Right. It is true that that as you get older, the risk goes up. So someone who's over the age of 85 has a very high risk of a hospitalization if they develop the flu. But to set an age and say 70 or 75 is where we should start vaccinating, it's just a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Lisa.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Joanne, to get back to a point that was raised in a call earlier, which we did not address, Annie, the caller, I think, from Sandy, Utah, said that she had heard that the Bush administration knew well in advance of the problems attendant with the vaccines. As you mentioned, there have been a lot of questions about from various groups warning that the system was fragile. But is there any information that anybody knew in advance that there was going to be a shortage?
I don't think they really knew until August when Chiron came out and said that there were a couple of contaminated lots and talked about pulling a couple of million, or they didn't say at first how many doses were going to be pulled off, but it was a small number of doses, and that was the first with this particular problem. And I think what they've really known over the years is that it's a fragile supply system, and as the other caller mentioned, you know, pharmaceutical companies have been getting out of, there's no profit in it, they've been getting out of the business rather than into the business. So the mega problem has been known for a long time. This year's episodic problem really, I think, just came up in August.
Okay. Let's get another caller on the line. This is John, who's with us from Wilmington, Delaware.
Hi, I'm an international flight attendant, and I'm kind of concerned about some of the issues that are out there with the avian flu, the bird flu, and the current climate that we're advancing into. My concern is that with the high cost of jet fuel, a lot of air carriers are flying with the air packs turned down as low as they can for circulated air in order to save fuel. And this concerns me, because I know we're transporting a lot of people globally, and I'm wondering what the doctor thinks about the quality of air and the flu virus, the flu virus in particular, on an aircraft.
Dr. Trainer?
Well, it's been recognized that there have been occasional outbreaks of flu that appear to have been the result of aerosolized transmission in airplanes, but they're very rare. So I don't think there's any information that would really help you decide how much of an impact on transmission would result from changes in air handling on aircraft. I'd have to say it's not an area that I'm an expert in. My guess would be that probably does have some very small impact on transmission, but how much overall impact it has is really hard to say.
Would you suspect that there are professions where people who are otherwise not at high risk might be at a high risk of exposure, healthcare workers, teachers?
Sure, and I think maybe we should differentiate two different kinds of high risk. There are people who are at a high risk of getting the flu, and there are people who are at a high risk of having complications of flu if they become ill. And our vaccine strategy is currently, and has been always, designed to try and prevent those complications. We don't use vaccine typically in the people who have the highest risk of getting the flu, which are school children. And many people have suggested that if we went down that road, we might be able to impact transmission. But right now, when we say high risk, we're talking about people who are at high risk to have complications once they get the flu, and not talking about people who might be at high risk for being exposed to the flu.
Mm-hmm. Joanne, reporters at high risk?
Well, just that we're out in the public as everybody else's. I don't think we're at higher risk than anyone else.
I was just joking.
High risk of colds, yes.
High risk of colds. High risk of colds. Any other groups that you can think of, Joanne?
That would be at especially high risk? No, I mean, really, to me, the group that's really needs to be focused on are healthcare workers, because they can not only get it and not be able to deliver healthcare, but they can also give it to the people they're caring for.
And obviously,
boy, I would definitely second that. That is still a very high priority target for flu vaccination.
And obviously, a high percentage of the people they're caring for would be at risk themselves. So it's sort of a circle there. John, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking about the shortage of flu vaccine and what to do about it. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Dr. Trainer, remind us, flu is it's a cause of, what, tens of thousands of deaths every year?
The estimates are that it's on the average responsible for from 30,000 to 40,000 excess deaths per year just in the United States.
And how does flu kill?
Well, there's a lot of different things that can go wrong when you have the flu. Clearly, the flu itself can cause pneumonia, and that can be fatal. And it also predisposes to infections by bacteria, which take advantage of the damaged mucosal surface left after the flu virus has attacked to gain a toehold and then cause either bacterial pneumonia or other bacterial infections.
Is there...
But then...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, in addition, there's increasing evidence that flu virus infection can also lead to other complications that aren't as direct, like heart attacks and stroke, that maybe have something to do with the body's inflammatory response to being infected.
Okay. Let's get another caller on the line. One thing before we go to Ken in Las Vegas. Hang with us, Ken. I just pushed your button. I did want to ask, is there a moment at which people should decide whether or not to go to a hospital?
Well, I think the usual advice for seeking a hospitalization would be a prolonged cough that's getting worse, particularly if it's accompanied by difficulty breathing or production of blood or cloudy sputum.
And a fever of?
And fever. Well, there's really not a cutoff for fever that I would say should prompt someone to go to the hospital. Now, I will point out that there are antiviral drugs that are available for treatment of the flu. And those drugs are only effective if they're administered very early. And so one thing that people might want to bear in mind is if they do develop the classic flu symptoms and they can see their physician within the first 2 days of their illness, they may be able to receive antiviral therapy that will shorten the duration of the illness and probably reduce the risk of subsequent complications.
Okay. Ken, you've been patient with us. Ken joins us now from Las Vegas.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yes, I wonder whether Dr. Trainer isn't being far too conservative in his advice about the steps that people should take to prevent catching the flu virus themselves. I was in Hong Kong during the SARS epidemic. I was a professor there. And Hong Kong basically conquered the SARS epidemic without effective medications and without any vaccine, just by training the populace on how to use good personal hygiene to avoid the virus. And transmission of the flu virus is very similar to that of SARS. So measures like keeping your hands clean, carrying some wet wipes with you to clean your hands, assuming that all public services, public surfaces like the stair railings, the ATM machine keys, and the pen that you borrowed to sign your credit card slip, they all have the virus. And being careful that you don't transmit that virus from those surfaces to your eyes, nose, and mouth. Also, limiting your alcohol intake and not staying out till 3, using the stairs instead of the elevator to avoid that person in the elevator who's going to sneeze on you. Those kind of things can greatly reduce your chance of catching the flu.
Dr. Trainer?
Well, I think that's a very thoughtful list of things to do. It's important to recognize that the way that SARS was transmitted and the way that the flu is transmitted are really very different. And probably the most important difference is that SARS doesn't appear to have been transmitted until people were really quite ill. And so almost all of the SARS transmission took place within the hospital setting. And I think this is one of the reasons why infection control practices within the hospital could play such an important role in preventing the spread of SARS. Now, unfortunately, a lot of flu transmission takes place right as the illness is beginning or even before the person becomes symptomatic. And so those kinds of isolation procedures that worked for SARS probably would not work well for the flu.
Ken, thanks very much for the phone call.
All right. You're welcome.
Today we're talking about flu vaccines, and in a few minutes we're going to be switching the topic to talk about the presidential election in Afghanistan. But first we want to wind up our conversation with Dr. John Trainer, who's a professor of medicine in the infectious diseases unit at the University of Rochester, and with NPR health policy correspondent Joanne Silberner, and get more of your questions on the line. Here's with us George in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes.
You're on the air, George.
Okay, great. My question is for Dr. Trainer, and I was wondering, I've heard from other physicians on other news programs that if you have a flu shot this season, and then last season, and then not a flu shot this season, you actually increase your risk of getting the flu this year because of the mutation, and I was wanting to get the doctor's thoughts on that, please.
No, I don't think you really need to worry about that, George. There is no evidence that I know of that having had a flu shot in the past increases your chance of getting the flu. Now, you may remember that the flu viruses do change every year or every couple of years, which is the reason why we have to keep updating the flu shots, and that's actually how we got into this problem in the first place. But this year, there really hasn't been a change in the virus, and that's the good news, because it may mean that the epidemic won't be quite as severe. But there's no reason to think that having gotten a flu shot in the past somehow would increase your risk of getting the flu this year.
I see. Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for the program.
Thanks, George. Let's go to Barbara. Barbara's calling from San Francisco.
Hi there.
Hi.
I would appreciate if Dr. Trainer could discuss the efficacy of the anti-flu nasal spray, Flu Mist, and whether it would be effective as an alternative to a flu shot.
Doctor?
Well, that's a great question, and actually I think there's a lot of data that supports the efficacy of Flu Mist. In healthy adults, it looks like Flu Mist probably works about as well as a flu shot does. So that's a very good alternative for healthy adults to prevent influenza.
Let me just follow up with that. Joanne, as I understood it, one of the companies that made the Flu Mist didn't sell very much of it and has since gone out of business. Doesn't make it anymore.
No, it still makes it. It's only one company up in Maryland, and they made a lot last year that they had to discard. They're making much, much less this year. I think this would have been a great opportunity for them, but they didn't see it coming.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Trainer?
Well, right. I think what you may remember is that originally the flu mist vaccine, which is a product made by a company called MedImmune, was going to be co-marketed with a much larger vaccine company, Wyeth. And because of a variety of reasons, but in part of the poor sales last year, Wyeth withdrew from that arrangement, and now that vaccine is made and marketed solely by MedImmune.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if it's available, this would be for healthy people, you're saying, a good idea.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think the ideal population would be healthcare workers because those are people who are targeted for vaccination and who could get flu mist because they're in the group for which flu mist is licensed.
Barbara, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
One final question, doctor. What about chicken soup?
Well, chicken soup is great. I love chicken soup. I don't think you could really count on it to prevent the flu, but it would certainly help make you feel better if you had the flu.
Dr. Trainer, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
John Trainer is a professor of medicine in the Infectious Diseases Unit at the University of Rochester. He was with us from the studios of member station WXXI in Rochester, New York. Joanne Silberner, thank you very much. Joanne was with us here in Studio 3A, and she's going to go home and take care of that cold.